This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. Today we're going to talk with a writer I barely knew a year ago, but who in that time has become one of my favorites, New York novelist Paul Auster. He has a new book, new novel out called Invisible, which I just finished reading and absolutely loved. And then in the second half of the program, I guess you could say, if you want to define Paul Auster's writing, and it's very difficult to define if you haven't read it, that they are very elegant literary soap operas. And in the second half of the program, we're going to talk with the author of a series of very unliterate, inelegant, very sordid soap operas. That's David Comfort, who has written the Rock and Roll Book of the Dead. To start, though, with Paul Auster, I've got him on the line now. Welcome to Booktown.
Thank you.
As I said, I hadn't read your work till about a year ago. I've read six novels in that time, and I've been blown away by almost every one of them. They're very hard to describe if nobody has read them before, because what I just said about being elegant literary soap operas doesn't come even close. I think maybe one way to get at them is to talk about how you got to them, because I, from reading a little bit of your biography in one source or another, I know that you have said that until your mid-teens, nothing interested you till baseball. Then in your 20s, you devoted yourself to poetry and translation, and at a certain point stopped that, and your poetry is, to my mind, totally different from your fiction. So I'm sort of curious what drew you to poetry, and then what drew you away from poetry to fiction?
Well, the fact is, when I was young, I was doing both at the same time. However, the prose that I was writing in my late teens, early to mid-20s, never satisfied me. I have notebook after notebook filled with bits of novels, thousands of pages, I think, but I just wasn't happy with it. And the poetry seemed to be working better. And so at some point, probably in my mid-20s, I focused on that exclusively, thinking that prose was never going to happen for me. But lo and behold, I came to some kind of wall with the poetry and didn't write anything for about a year. And then when I started again, it was prose, and I've continued that way ever since. So for more than 30 years, just prose and mostly fiction, some nonfiction as well.
And your poems, the few that I've read online largely, are very spare, very tight and impersonal, I would say, and they don't give any real indication of where you are or who you're involved with. I've got one in front of me called White Nights. I'll just read the beginning. No one here, and the body says, whatever is said is not to be said, but no one is a body as well, and what the body says is heard by no one but you. And it goes on like that for about a page. Your novels, on the other hand, are so specific and so detail-full and so dependent on the specific characters and their interaction. I can barely fit the two personalities together.
Well, I think actually the concerns that are expressed in my poetry are very much the concerns that one finds in my early fiction. And it's mostly about reaching out to the other. It's mostly about the I-you question and about solitary consciousness as opposed to, well, what can one call it? Love, the possibility of connecting with somebody else. So even though the poems might seem abstract to you, they're very grounded in real experience. It's just a different aesthetic. I mean, when you're telling stories, obviously, you need to put in all the details.
And what struck me when I was reading Invisible last night, and I made a point of not starting to read it till yesterday, was just the joy of invention it seems to demonstrate. There may be that you still have this question of how people reach to one another and how they're involved with one another, how they invent one another, but it gets caught up in a story that pulls you in and won't let go of you until it's done.
Well, I'm glad you felt that way. That's obviously music to my ears to hear that you were absorbed. That's I think the first thing any novelist wants to hear from a reader.
And I think that's what I've seen again and again in blurbs. People say, well, I picked this book up and I couldn't put it down until I was done.
Good.
In this case, I knew that was going to be my reaction, or I could almost guess it. There's only one book that didn't quite hold me that way, and I won't say which one it was. And so I started reading it at 6 o'clock last night, and I knew I would be done with it by 10 this morning, and I was, and had a grand trip.
Good.
Now, the novels tend to involve literary people. They tend to involve a younger man and quite often an older man, sometimes from the point of view of the older, but, well, it depends. Sometimes from the point of view of the younger. There's usually a woman or two involved, sometimes a sort of seductive one and a more nurturing one. And however they start out, they quickly get caught up in other people's stories.
Mm-hmm.
They're all novels or stories within stories.
I know that. Quite a few of my books function that way. There are other books I've written that just move in a line, you know, from point A to B to C, all the way to the end. And then others are, you know, what you might call the Chinese box effect. But I tend to think of it as collage. And so that if you have two or three or four stories told in a single novel, it's as if you've got these three or four elements within a frame, and there's always space between the elements. And I feel that there's some kind of energy that's emitted that makes it more powerful than if you just had one element. It's hard to define it and describe it, but it's an instinctive thing that just comes up organically as I'm working.
Actually, all of the books that I've read, and I'll just tell you the ones I've read have been Moon Palace, The Book of Illusions, Oracle Knight, The Brooklyn Follies, Man in the Dark, and now Invisible.
Mm-hmm.
And Brooklyn Follies is a little straightforward, but it has a lot of digressions in it.
Yes. It's my one stab at a comic novel. It is a comedy in the sense that just about everyone in the book is a little better off at the end of the story than they were at the beginning.
And in the others, sometimes I get so caught up in the internal stories, especially in the Book of Illusions,
mm-hmm.
that I was actually disappointed to come back to the framing characters.
Well, what can I say? There it is. There are the two things going on. We have our narrator, Zimmer, and then he's investigating the life of Hector Mann, this old silent film actor, presumed dead, and turns out not dead. And so, yeah, we're bouncing between the two.
And as I said, that was so compelling that I couldn't put it down, and I firmly believe that Hector Mann is now a real silent screen actor. He may not have been a few years ago, but he is now.
Me too.
I think he should start showing up in the histories of Western movies.
I think there are already a few textbooks that he's mentioned, but I can't remember the title.
Yeah. Now, Invisible is a story of what happened in 1967 by a Columbia student, Adam Walker, and how he encounters a French professor named Rudolf Born. What happens to them that spring, that summer, that fall? And that's as far as he gets, because he's writing it when he's an old man. He knows he's dying. And in the end, he passes on part of his manuscript to an old college friend who's an established novelist and essentially says, here, you figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't really know how much of what he tells is true, because some of the, when Jim, the novelist, contacts some of the other characters, they say some of it's true, some of it is not. They'll admit to some of it is fabricated, some of it is elaborated upon. And in the end, you don't know, except there's the one thing you didn't expect comes out in the last three or four pages.
Mm-hmm.
It's,
mm-hmm.
as I said, was just about impossible to put down. And in this case, it's almost like the characters, instead of coming upon other stories that they tell themselves, they're telling their own stories and trying to figure out what went on as they tell them.
Well, because I think the book explores the question of memory, and the older you get, the murkier things become from the past, and it's hard to know if you're remembering correctly. And it's also about how a book is made, without giving away too much, yes, Jim does become involved in the creation of the book you're holding in your hand, so you don't know exactly what he's done to the original material. Or you don't know what the original material was, I guess. And so we're in an ambiguous zone. I mean, there's a crime committed, but whether it was as horrific as Walker imagined it was or not is unclear. And many things are unclear. And I suppose you could say, in the end, it's a book about ambiguity, not knowing, not being certain about things.
And what does the title have to do with that?
Well, I think it's directly related to it. Invisible means you can't see. And the word is used three or four times very consciously throughout the book. In the first passage, Bourne's face is described as being a face that would become invisible in any crowd. Then at one point, Walker talks about the downtrodden in America, the invisible ones, meaning the very poor. At another point, he's riding in an airplane, and it's in dark, he's traveling across the continent, and an invisible America lay beneath me. And then in the very last passage of the book, as you remember, someone is walking down a hill, hearing things, some noises that make no sense to her whatsoever. She can't begin to decipher what she's hearing. Only when she finally sees them can she make sense of it. And so that last scene is a kind of little metaphor for the entire book, I think.
And that comes right after Rudolf Born has maybe admitted to a different crime that nobody imagined he committed, but maybe he didn't admit
it. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he's just fooling around, and you really can't know. You absolutely can't know.
And in a sense, this is the Bourne, in some ways, destroys Adam Walker by what happens, and in other ways, he allows him to completely recreate himself as something he never would have imagined beforehand.
Exactly, exactly. You're totally right about that.
Now, I would like to, one of the characters, the one who is walking down the hill at the end, Cecile, she meets Jim, the novelist, at a certain point and gives him her diary of her final encounter with Rudolf Born. And along the way, she pulls out her red binder and says, now I'm going to start asking you some questions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, can I ask you those questions?
Sure.
You said that this book is sort of about how a novel gets written, and in it, Jim is given material from Adam Walker and from Cecile, and he winds up putting it together. He admits that he changes the names, he changes some of the circumstances, some of the happenings. But it's largely based on what is supposedly a true tale told to him.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you work?
No, because I really, I'm working purely out of my imagination. You know, the book purports to be a kind of autobiography, but my work is not. I'm the nonfiction, of course. My autobiographical works are based on things that really happened to me, but nearly everything of my novels is pure fabrication. Except, of course, as every novelist does, I use places I've been to, jobs I've had, but all these characters are invented characters, not based on anyone I know.
I happen to have been in New York City in the summer of 1967 at Columbia, where it starts out and where you attended.
Oh, interesting.
I started taking a summer class in French and then discovered I would much rather study Manhattan than the language, and I dropped out after a week and just walked the city. And I'm trying to guess. I went to many movies, and I may have gone to see Carl Dreyer's Odette at the New Yorker Theater.
It's quite possible. I don't know if it was playing that summer. But
yeah, I that's what I was going to ask you. And I had an apartment not far from West End Avenue, and I know that the details seem very, very precise. I wondered if you actually checked back to see if that movie was showing that summer.
No, it's just a movie that made a huge impression on me. I know I saw it as an undergraduate, so somewhere between 1965 and 1969, in the balcony of the New Yorker Theater, as happens in the book. It's a remarkable film. There's a resurrection scene at the end that is absolutely astonishing. But in the novel, I actually do record what happened in the audience, was that half the people there did burst out laughing, and I think the other half were transported by it. I was one of those who was transported by the scene.
And I'll have to admit that I do not remember it. I remember seeing the movie, but some of Dreyer's other movies, like The Passion of Joan of Arc, and
yes,
made an even greater impression on
it. Well, it's a much greater film, I think, as well.
Other things in the movie, you know, I can't quite tell if it's a book or a novel or a movie. The obscure Greek poet.
Lycophron, real poet.
Who's absolutely a real one, yeah.
Yes, yes.
And although when I looked him up today, some people say that the works attributed to him may have been written by other people who were banking on his reputation for obscurity.
Well, it's possible. I just know about Lycophron. It's an interesting story. I discovered his work long, long ago, when I was in my mid-20s, I think, and I came across, and I quoted in my first prose book, The Invention of Solitude, one of the ones you haven't read yet, and there was a brilliant translation done by a certain Lord Royston in 1808, and Royston was a genius, and who died in a shipwreck at the age of 23 or 24, and so his Lycophron translation is really the only thing that survives of his work, and it's a great English poem, completely unknown. I found it buried in the Columbia Library somewhere, and made a photocopy, which I still have. That is extraordinary. The Loeb edition, your mind around that, any piece of writing I've ever seen, James Joyce included.
Right, and you seem to delight in these obscure literary references, not so much for their own sake as because they delight your characters.
Well, Cecile is a brilliant young girl, and of course she would tackle the most difficult thing possible. And I think the very nature of that project reveals something about who she is.
But then you have quotes like, I think it's Adam is reading George Oppen, who's
yes,
a not terribly well-known modern poet.
One of my very favorites, I have to say.
And I'm trying to remember, I think it's in Man in the Dark, there's a lot about Hawthorne, although there also is in the Brooklyn Follies. It's
mm-hmm,
a little hard
mm-hmm.
to keep it all straight. And your characters will be devoted to Hawthorne or James or Melville or Emily Dickinson comes up again and again.
Well, it's a funny thing is, you see, I have a very open policy about what can be in a book, in a novel, and I believe it's everything. And I'm always fascinated by the fact that in novel after novel after novel, nobody reads books, which seems extremely strange. Books are a big part of the lives of millions upon millions of people. And so many of my characters are big readers. And therefore, what they read becomes part of their lives and part of the story.
And part of what the stories that they invent.
At times, yes.
Although I at the beginning referred to your novels as being in some ways elegant soap operas, and I think Invisible definitely falls in that category. Other ones, like in Moon Palace, the events that happen to the painter in the West could have almost come out of a dime novel from 1880.
Oh, yes, but I was consciously trying to write a Western, and I had a great time with that. That's a book that was published more than 20 years ago, but yes, there is the Wild West in that book.
And the two that strike me the most as being most similar, that Hector Mann's story has so much in common with that dime novel melodrama.
You mean The Moon Palace?
No, that Hector Mann in Book of Illusions.
Yes, well...
Because his story is about as lurid as they come.
Yes, well, he goes through an enormous spiritual journey, Hector Mann, throughout the course of the book. I don't know if I would define these as soap operas, though, but we won't mince words.
Okay, I guess it's because they involve strange turns of plot and heightened emotions, and there's a lot of nastiness as well as goodness in the characters, and there's a fair amount of revenge. I was actually rather shocked in Oracle Knight, the first one I read, the character, the narrator, I expected to be a fairly genial person, and I was amazed at the anger and bitterness that welled up in him.
Well, some terrible things happened to his wife, and he's very, very angry. And I think understandably. But you see, many of my characters are in extremis in one way or another. They're living through, you know, extreme situations. And that's what I'm interested in writing about. I think in the Book of Illusions, someone says, you know, you only find out who you are when your back is up against the wall. And so my characters are tested in sometimes rather terrible ways.
Now, you also write screenplays.
I've done a number of those, yes.
And the only one I've actually seen is Smoke, mm-hmm. and I saw it before I read any of your books, but I realize now that it also is telling several stories simultaneously.
Yes, yes, it interweaves. I think Smoke and the Brooklyn Follies are similar kinds of works. One is a film, one is a novel, but they both take place in the same neighborhood in Brooklyn, and they're about what we might call families or invented families, how people come together and forge alliances, sometimes unlikely ones. And both books are about that, about making families.
And would you consider both of them comedies?
Yes.
Yeah, that was definitely the impression I had from Smoke. It was rather grim at times, but good-humoredly grim.
Yes, exactly. People are making a lot of jokes, and they're delighting in their verbal abilities to make others laugh, too.
And you talk about your characters being an extremist and being... What goes on to them is a process of discovery. Which is more important, the humor or the discovery?
Oh, the discovery, of course. But I don't know if you can make discoveries if you don't have some sense of humor.
Okay, and that's why I was a little put off at times by... Oracle Knight, although I found it was the first one that I couldn't stop reading. It was the first one I read, and I read it straight through in, you know, half a dozen hours. But there wasn't... Well, actually, the older... Now that I think of it, the narrator was the one who had very little sense of humor, it struck me, but his older friend could look on with a bit of amusement.
Yes, yes, Trouse, he's older, and yes... you have to understand that Sidney, the narrator, is coming out of terrible illness. He nearly died. He's very wobbly, trying to get his life back in order. And no, to me, it's one of the books I cling to of the ones I've written. I think I feel very close to that one. Well, I feel close to them all, actually.
And that just knocked a question out of my head. I will leave it at that because our 25 minutes is actually up, and I could talk. Oh, I know. I'm just going to ask this once. When you talk about your characters, and some novelists do this, but some don't. I've thrown out half a dozen characters in half a dozen books, and you immediately start talking to them as if they were real people.
They are real people. For me, they're absolutely real, as real as any of the flesh and blood human beings I know.
And that's probably why I get that, as I said at the very beginning, this joy of invention. And that must be what makes your books so compelling. Well, maybe so.
I just don't know what to tell you, but you might be right.
Okay. Thanks so much, Paul Auster.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Thome. I'll be right back. And I'm back. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Thome, and I'll be here, as I mentioned, till a little before 2 p.m. And from the imagined soap operas, or very elegant, melodramatic Chinese box collages of Paul Auster that we were talking about in the first half of the program, we're going to go to real soap operas and very sordid ones. And once it most of my listeners, I think, were probably somewhat familiar with, but not in the detail that they will be in a short time. I'm going to be talking with David Comfort, who's written the rock and roll Book of the Dead, The Fatal Journey of Rock's Seven Immortals. And these are Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Elvis Presley, John Lennon, Kurt Cobain, and Jerry Garcia. And they all ended their lives in rather horrific ways. And as David Comfort talks about that, he also talks about the pretty great horror of the way they lived before that. Welcome to Booktown, David.
Thanks, Eric.
When I started out, when I was first told about this book and suggested that I might want to read it and might want to interview you, I thought, well, I'll take it, but I don't think it'll work for me because I'm not that interested in most of the people you write about, but I'll pass it on to one of the other KVMR broadcasters and they can interview you. But just like the Paul Auster books I was talking about in the first half of the program, I couldn't put it down, and I very quickly found out a whole lot more about the lives and deaths of these people than I thought I wanted to know.
Yeah, I understand that. I mean, I was certainly a fan of some of these people, not all of them. But in terms of American iconography, they're at the top, pretty much. I mean, you can argue a few of them, but they were living legends. And that's why I chose the seven of them, not necessarily for intrinsic artistic merit, but just the sort of enormous pressures they had to endure and survive as living legends, and what that does to a human being, a particularly hypersensitive and artistic people like these.
And people who very quickly developed, almost all of them, drug and alcohol problems and real problems of anger and despair.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Of course, the anger and despair, I think, came early on, way before they were stars. As I explain in my book, nobody's childhood is a picnic, but the childhoods of these seven were particularly traumatic. There was a lot of abuse, a lot of abandonment, a lot of booze, a lot of violence, and a lot of death, actually, of close relatives and friends. And made for hypersensitive people who were just really, really traumatized by all of this. And they did indeed reinvent themselves, in a sense, and transcend their childhoods, but they never left their childhoods. And it's a very interesting thing about rock and roll, and these people in particular, they were all incredibly attached to their childhoods. You know, it's the old Pete Townsend line, hope I die before I get old. They were so attached to it, and I explore that to some extent, and rock and roll is, of course, a youthful artistic phenomenon, you know, much more so than any other.
And when I talked to you last night, I mentioned that initially there were only two of these people who had interested me much in the past, who were John Lennon and Jim Morrison. And you said pretty much the same for you, except maybe Hendrix also.
Hendrix, yeah.
But now you've gotten involved in all of their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not necessarily. I mean, I suppose it's helped me appreciate their music a little more. For example, I never particularly appreciated Cobain's music. I do a little more now. Not he's my favorite, but knowing all of these people much better now and their backgrounds, it certainly has. It's certainly very potent. You know?
Along the way, you come up with some different versions of the deaths of some of these people than we've normally heard. Some of them, like Jerry Garcia, there is pretty much what we had expected.
But yes,
you say right. That you think that Elvis committed suicide and that Hendrix and Cobain were murdered.
Yes, I do.
Maybe we should take those one at a time.
Well, the two murder mysteries would be Hendrix and Cobain. I'm not saying this for the first time. I think I'm fleshing this out a good deal more than others have. Let's start with, you want to start with Hendrix?
Sure.
Jimi Hendrix had a manager who was almost out of fiction. He was a guy by the name of Mike Jeffrey, and he was at the bottom of Hendrix's horrific fate. He used to be a manager for the Animals, but before he got into rock and roll, he was with the MI6, which is military intelligence, and he was essentially an MI6 assassin in the Cold War. I mean, he and a specialist in dynamiting and all that kind of stuff. And then he got involved with another manager who really they called him the Godfather of English pop, and he took no prisoners either. This is he learned his chops from the MI6 and essentially the mafia, and so he got involved with Hendrix. And Hendrix, of course, was his golden goose, and he started embezzling from Hendrix big time. And Hendrix was just satisfied as long as he had more Stratocasters, more Corvettes, and more coke and hallucinogens, and wasn't watching the books particularly while Jeffries was ripping him off blind. And when Hendrix finally figured this out, what was going on, he decided to fire him. Well, Jeffrey couldn't be fired because if he got fired, they would have examined the books. He probably would have gone to prison for extortion, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a lot more to it than that. And in any case, the conventional wisdom is Hendrix aspirated on his own vomit? Well, not quite. The vomit was pure red wine. That is to say, somebody opened his mouth after he took those, barbiturates were either forced on him or whatever. Somebody opened his mouth and started pouring wine down his throat until he literally drowned. And Jeffrey, in fact, confessed to this shortly before he himself disappeared in an airplane accident. And all the indices are that he was responsible. So that's the short version of the Hendrix thing. I mean, it's quite incredible what Jeffries did to him. I mean, he kidnapped him at one point at gunpoint, took him up to Woodstock blindfolded. And another time, it seems quite clear that when Hendrix was busted in Toronto for heroin, Jeffries set that whole thing up just to scare him and intimidate him. And then the climax, of course, was having him murdered. Should we go on to Cobain?
Okay.
Cobain, of course, the theory has been out there for some time that he didn't indeed commit suicide. He was murdered. There was a conspiracy to murder him. First of all, a few specifics. Now, 6 weeks before he died, he was in Rome ending a concert, or actually discontinuing a tour because of poor health. And he rendezvoused with his wife, Courtney Love, at that time, who was having an affair with Billy Corgan of the Pumpkins. And their relationship, to say the least, at the time was rancorous, very ugly. And so he wanted to divorce Courtney, and which meant Courtney was going to lose all her money. She was going to lose her golden goose, and he was going to write her out of his will. So in Rome, when he broke all that to him, lo and behold, a few hours later, you know, he's rushed to the hospital in a coma because somebody has slipped Rohypnol, the date rape pill, in his champagne, 60 hits worth, and that happened to be Courtney's prescription. Then 6 weeks later, of course, he was found in his greenhouse, which was essentially the attic of his home, and with a shotgun by his side. However, this is really strange. I mean, the shotgun was completely wiped down. There were no identifiable fingerprints on it. He was shot up with three times the maximum fatal overdose of heroin, meaning that he would have immediately lost consciousness and been incapable of pulling a trigger. Thirdly, the note that was left, the so-called suicide note, half of it was forged, and it was probably Courtney's forgery. Her lawyer found forged papers in her knapsack where she was practicing Kurt's handwriting. Another aspect is the two main people in the Seattle department who examined that case were good friends of Courtney's. Sergeant Cameron, who was the detective, and the ME, the medical examiner, Hartshorn, was a good friend of hers, too. And she said to her private detective, as long as they're on the case, I have no fears, you know. And she had her lawyers destroy the death scene photos, which would have told a great deal. And then later on, after this happened, a guy by the name of Elton Hoke scored a 99.9% on a polygraph, saying that Courtney called him a few months before to whack my old man for $50,000. And, of course, we know that her history of violence with other people is incredibly prolific with her first husband, and she tried to burn him up in bed. She threatened him with hitmen and all the rest. So I'm not saying as a fact that he was murdered, but all that I'm certainly convinced of it. But it's worthy of looking into, and I think I look into it in a good deal of detail here.
And there was even a band started up called Courtney Killed Kurt.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was actually Elton Hoke's band, because after Elton Hoke, the guy who said that Courtney approached him about a hit on him, and then very strangely, Elton Hoke, shortly after he revealed who he thought was the real guy who had been employed to kill Kurt, was found on the railroad tracks. He was thrown in front of a train. And so there was no way to get any more information from him.
Now, do you think you are in any danger with this out?
No, I don't think so. One really difficult thing for Courtney, I mean, other people have said this, and she's certainly threatened them with lawsuits and all the rest. She does a good deal of sword rattling. But bottom line, she knows very well that if she does sue somebody or go after them, it's going to give a lot of publicity to whatever book or publication that is, and it's going to defeat her very purpose. And also, she really doesn't have much of a leg to stand on here in terms of libel, because a lot of this is said before, and as you probably know, the legal bar for libel on a celebrity is huge, because the public's right to know always outstrips a celebrity's, unless it's egregious, celebrities, you know, intend to keep things secret.
Now, these two supposed suicides or accidental deaths you think were murders,
yes.
And you think, on the other hand, that Elvis's apparent overdose was a suicide.
Yeah, I do. Just generically going, I mean, obviously when somebody commits suicide, there's a good reason for it. I mean, things are absolutely falling apart for them, and they certainly were for Elvis. At the end of his life, a book had just come out called Elvis, What Happened, and it was written by his bodyguards, whom he had recently fired, and they say they didn't write the book out of spite, but to try and protect Elvis from himself and his drug abuse. In any case, the book revealed for the first time that Elvis was a major pharmaceutical junkie, and also that he had an incredibly violent side. You know, and all of these things he didn't want revealed. And he didn't know exactly how to rescue his reputation from this. Another thing was he was just at 42. He was exhausted. He was through. He had done so much touring. He was just fried. He was on the brink of bankruptcy, like Michael Jackson. He was a rock and roll dinosaur. He thought his fiance was cheating on him. I mean, everything had fallen apart for Elvis, and I think he really wanted to die. So at the very end of his life, he went to a dentist, as he often would, for some of his fixes, and just for an emergency appointment, and he got a bottle of codeine, to which he knew he was allergic. And he was taking huge quantities of other narcotics, but the codeine was the kicker that probably put him into anaphylactic shock. And because he 23 times the usual dose was found in his stomach of codeine plus all these other drugs, so it just kicked him over the edge. So that's my personal theory on Elvis. Now, you know, I mean, suicide, you can say there's first-degree suicide and second-degree suicide, right? I mean, first-degree suicide is somebody who actually puts a gun to their head and just shoots himself. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing obscure about that. Now, second-degree, I mean, it could be Elvis was second-degree. Like, somebody like Elvis, like many of the others, they were like freeway matadors. I mean, they would walk across the freeway, in a sense, figuratively, and didn't really care whether they lived or died, you know? And that's the way he was living, and the others were at the end, too. They just didn't particularly care.
You draw so many comparisons and similarities among these people. One of, and most of it, is of misery, violence, and addiction. But one is of their reflection, self-reflection, and looking at their lives and what it is to be a celebrity. And even Elvis, who you considered probably the least reflective of the group, thought pretty hard about being Elvis, and he couldn't figure out why he was.
Yeah, he did. I mean, he felt for a long time that I'm Elvis because God meant me to be Elvis. So he felt like, in a sense, he was on a divine mission. But at the end, you know, he was sick of being a rock and roll star. And he said, I should never have left the church, because, of course, he grew up as a Southern Baptist. I should have been a preacher, you know. His other huge regret, and this is strange, because the others, you know, these are people who seem to have the world, who seem to have conquered the world, and yet they were still so dissatisfied and regretful. In Elvis's case, he said to his fiance at the end, you know, I'm nothing. How will they remember me? I've never done a great classic movie like On the Waterfront, and he really aspired to be a great actor on that level. I mean, he didn't concentrate on all the conquests he had, but just the lack, you know, and the others did in a sense too. They went down, most of them, with incredible regrets about one thing or another.
Most of them had, as you said, very unhappy childhoods.
Yeah.
And in particular, most of them either had no respect or outright hatred for their fathers.
Yeah.
But none of them were good fathers either.
No, they weren't. You know, that's especially ironic in the case of John Lennon particularly. John was abandoned by his father, or at least he liked to think he was abandoned by his father, when he was age 5. What actually happened was his father was in the Merchant Marine, and he came home to England, and he said to his wife, I want to move to New Zealand. We're moving to New Zealand. And she put her foot down and said, absolutely not. And so they put him in this Sophie's Choice situation that was incredibly traumatic for him. They said, okay, who are you going to go with? Are you going to go with me to New Zealand? Are you going to stay with your mother here in London? And he started weeping and ultimately decided to stay with his mother, and his father just took off. But no sooner did his mother take full custody than his aunt took custody of him, because his mother was kind of a bon vivant chick. You know, she loved to party, she loved to drink, and she wasn't the paradigm of a responsible mother. So he was brought up by his aunt, who was very, very different, a stern taskmaster and all the rest. In any case, the father issue. So he always resented his father for having abandoned him. And yet, so ironically, he did very much the same thing to his first son, Julian, that had been done to him. He treated Julian very, very badly and hardly ever saw him, mostly ignored him. So, you know, what goes around comes around, sort of.
And even with Sean, who he seemed in Double Fantasy, it seemed like he idolized him, but
yeah.
Apparently he got pretty tired of being a father.
He did, yeah. I mean, what the whole thing with these stars and Parenthood, they had a very at best ambivalent relationship with it. I mean, let's take Garcia for example. When he had his first kid, I mean, he didn't want kids, but when he did, he said, "This is going to ruin my career," you know. And others felt the same way. They could not be a big star or a great artist and have children. So you know, Lennon felt a little bit the same about his children. Than Garcia did his. I mean, in Garcia's eulogy, his daughter said, "Well, he may have been a great artist, but he was a shitty father." But there it is. Can you indeed be a great and compulsive artist and be a great parent? I think that's pretty difficult. But there are a bunch of rock and roll people who are living legends who have survived because of their children, not in spite of them. You know, it's given them a lifeline.
Who are some examples?
Well, I'd say definitely Bruce Springsteen and Dylan is another, and you know, most of the big people who have kids, and Keith Richards, he says, you know, one of the reasons I survived is because of my kids. Kids grow you up, and I needed to grow up.
Which is another point you said at the very beginning, that none of these people really ever grew up.
I don't think so. No, I mean they were so, even to the end, except maybe Garcia. He's sort of an exception mostly, but the others were so narcissistic and in many ways so childish that, yeah, it's too bad the transition was never made.
And Jerry Garcia was also the one who had a slight problem with violence, but nothing compared to the others.
Oh, nothing compared to the others, no. No, absolutely nothing. You know, it's because it's, you know, it's hurtful to even think about this. Everybody likes to think about John Lennon, for example, as, you know, give peace a chance, all you need is love kind of guru. But, I mean, he admitted that he beat women badly. He was a very violent guy. And, in a matter of fact, he thought he was predestined to die early because he had lived by violence, and he thought he would die by violence. And he did indeed.
Although he's the one who could really... was really working on it in himself.
He was. I mean, he acknowledged it, and he was trying to do something about it, which is admirable. Very, really complicated guy, Lennon. You know, one time he went to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist said to him, "Even with all your money, John, I couldn't possibly treat you because I'd have to charge you for each personality." I mean, the guy was not just a schizo. I mean, he had many, many different personalities. And then, you know, people ask you, well, what was John Lennon really like? I mean, there's no black or white answer to that on John or any of the others. They were very complicated, very different people, and it depended on what you when you met them and in what context.
I've always, probably in contrast to nearly everybody else in the world, somewhat liked Yoko. And yeah. In Double Fantasy, I think I actually liked her songs better than his for the most part.
Uh-huh.
Or the songs of his that I liked the best were ones that really responded to the difficulty of living with her.
Yeah, yeah.
But you don't make her out to be at all admirable.
No, I don't. Well, she used John Lennon. You know, not that John Lennon had not used many people in his own career, but there was very little love lost between them. I mean, the blush fell off the rose pretty quickly there, and the thing with Yoko was I think there was a deep resentment from Yoko about John. She felt like, you know, he had gained the world so quickly and become such a living legend, which she wanted to be in the art world. And she felt like, why him and not me? Essentially, I'm at least as great an artist, if not better. You know, and she was one of the pioneers in conceptual art, and she considered the Beatles just pop nonsense. And one of the reasons they got together and John was so impressed with her is she always told John, "Well, you're the only artist in this group. Why are you bothering with these silly love songs and all the rest? You know, go solo and show them what a great artist you are." But she was always also trying to be recognized as that herself, so there was a lot of resentment there. Which I understand, and I think she made a great contribution to the conceptual art world. But it's hard not to have, by and large, a negative view of the way she used not just what John Lennon, but her other husband.
And as with Hendrix and Cobain, he was probably about to leave her when he died.
Yes. Yes, right. Well, there in a number of different sources that seem quite legitimate and persuasive. She was on the cusp of divorcing John at that very point, and he knew the relationship was in trouble. I mean, you can see from the lyrics in Double Fantasy. I mean, the schizophrenia between I'm Losing You, for example, which is, you know, a sad song, and then Starting Over. I mean, he wished desperately that they would stay together and wanted to start over, but it was the jig was pretty much up, you know. And Yoko was the least maternal of many of the rock and roll women. She didn't want to be a mother to Sean, much less a mother to John. And John called her mother. I mean, she was very much of a mother figure for John, and she couldn't tolerate that, you know. She was the mother that he never had.
That's, again, as with the Paul Auster in the first half of the program, we have run out of time. Otherwise, we could probably talk for a good deal longer.
Oh, yeah.
But thanks so much, David Comfort, for coming on.
The book is
The Rock and Roll Book of the Dead, The Fatal Journey of Rock's Seven Immortals, and they are Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Elvis Presley, John Lennon, Kurt Cobain, and Jerry Garcia. So now I'm about to get out of here. So stay tuned for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.